Fantasy writers, I hope you'll be joining me for the All About Fantasy full-day virtual retreat on the 28th of September from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Time. Whether you write YA fantasy, romantasy, adult fantasy, epic fantasy, cozy fantasy, dystopian fiction, or any other variation of the genre, you won't want to miss out on this amazing day of learning dedicated especially to you and those writing in your genre. The lineup includes award-winning and best-selling authors, as well as literary agents and editors who specialize in the genre. You'll have an opportunity to submit your query letter for critique. The Story Engine, who is sponsoring the retreat, is also hosting an awesome giveaway of an All Things Fantasy storytelling package that contains a copy of each of their decks, Story Engine Deck and Deck of Worlds, each with their associated fantasy expansions, the mythology, dystopian, and fairy tale boosters, valued at $237. All delegates will also receive discounts when shopping on the Story Engine website. Come and learn, ask questions, and even more importantly, build community. To find out more and to register, go to my website, biancamaray.com, and look for the All About Fantasy tab. I hope to see you there. Are you looking for beta readers, some of whom might potentially become writing group members down the line? Are you wanting to be matched up with those writing in a similar genre and time zone so they can critique your work as you critique theirs at the same time? Your manuscript doesn't have to be complete to sign up for this 3,000-word evaluation. Now, this particular matchup will be open to registrations from now until the 30th of September, with the matchup emails going out on the 1st of October. For more information and to register, go to biancamaray.com and look for the Beta Reader Matchup tab. Hi there, and welcome to our show, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm Bianca Murray, and I'm joined by Carly Waters and Cece Lira from PS Literary Agency. Today's guest is the New York Times bestselling author of The Widow, The Child, and The Suspect. She has trained and worked with journalists all over the world. Previously, she was a senior writer at the Daily Mail, news editor at the Daily Telegraph, and chief reporter at the Mail on Sunday, where she won Reporter of the Year at the British Press Awards. Born in Cambridge, England, she lives in England. It's my pleasure to welcome Fiona Barton. Fiona, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks so much for inviting me on.
It's such a pleasure to chat with you. I remember quite a few years ago when I was teaching creative writing at the University of Toronto, I actually used opening chapters from The Widow to show my students how to grab attention immediately and then run with it. So it's quite surreal to be chatting with you now when I was showing them excerpts and be like, buy this book and study it so you can see how it's done.
Oh, how lovely.
And while we're talking about that, can we speak about having such huge success with your debut? Because that book just came out of nowhere. It was huge in Canada. It was huge in the US. It was huge in the UK. I mean, that must have been quite a surreal experience.
It was a totally surreal experience. Yes, I mean, it was a debut, so nobody knew I was writing it, and I just sort of noodled about with it and all that. And then it all just moved so fast. I had entered it for a competition. I'd written 10,000 words, and I was a journalist for many years, and 10,000 words is a lot of words for a journalist. So I got to 10,000 and thought, I've got nothing left to say. So a friend said, there's a competition. You can enter 10,000 words. And it was Search for a Bestseller, Richard and Judy Book Club. So I thought, nothing to lose. Sent it in and it was shortlisted. And so you then had to finish the book. You had 6 months to come up with the 80,000 words needed to finish the book. And so that's exactly what I needed, a deadline. And I was working abroad. I was in Myanmar at the time and I got on with it. And it was second. It was the runner up. And so I sent it to an agent, a couple of agents, and Madeleine Milburn, my wonderful agent, came back immediately and we were off to the races, really. I mean, it was just mad. It was mad. You know, she had it, and then there was a bit of a, you know, to and fro, different publishers wanted it, and then all of a sudden it was done. And I was the other side of the world in a different time zone. So I was totally out of sync with what was happening. And I'd wake up in the morning and all these emails would be there saying, we've sold it in Germany, we've sold it. And it was like, oh my God, you know, is this really happening to me? So yeah, very, very surreal and incredibly lucky.
That's amazing. And there's nothing quite like a swift kick up the butt, that kind of deadline. Well, this is great. You've written 10,000 words. Now we need the rest in 6 months. So you essentially had to teach yourself how to write a book in 6 months. Yeah. After you'd done that and it went back to them, was it a case of whoever was watching the show chose the winners? Did readers get to choose the winners? Or did the producers of the show choose the winners? How did that whole process look?
I think the producer, because I don't think it was even on the television anymore by then, but the Richard and Judy Book Club is a big deal. It's wonderful. They support so many authors. No, I think it's the producer plus Richard and Judy, the hosts, who are both authors themselves now. They looked at them all and chose. And so that was wonderful. And later, when it was published, they included it in their club picks. So they choose 6 books, I think it is, twice a year, which is wonderful for sales and things. So there was a judging and they said, you know, you were runner up, well done. And so I had something to tell agents when I was writing to them, which was brilliant, because so often the letters that you write to agents, you know, I've seen a few, you know, you're sort of trying to sell yourself, but it's lovely to have a real hook to say, actually, you know, I was picked from whatever, you know, I was shortlisted. And it sort of gets the juices running a bit for the agents, I think.
Yeah, because there's always that bio paragraph in your query letter. And people are like, well, I haven't published before. I'm not quite sure what to put you. But like you say, if you enter contests, you never quite know where it's going to lead. And it is something that's going to grab someone's attention. Did you and Madeline then work for quite a while to revise what you had written and submitted? Or was it a case of she was quite happy with what you'd done and that's what she then sent up?
We worked, it was only really sort of 2 or 3 months. She wanted to build up the journalist, Kate Waters, a bit more. So we did that. You know, the book had sort of, it had evolved, but I had done right at the beginning, you know, in whenever it was, when I was in Sri Lanka, in fact, I had written 9 chapters, the beginning of the book, and I'd written the last chapter. I knew exactly what was going to happen. It was the middle was the tricky bit, obviously, as always. So I had started by thinking that Jean, my widow, would be the only voice. She would tell the story. I'd just read a really good book which did that, The Reluctant Fundamentalist, written from one point of view, and I loved it. Anyway, I started and I thought, oh, this is ridiculous. We've got to have other points of view. So I had got Kate, the nosy reporter, knocking on the door at the beginning because I needed Jean to be able to tell people things. But as I started writing Kate, you know, it was like coming home. It was lovely. You know, she had been everywhere I'd been, basically. So Maddie encouraged me to do more with Kate. So she, you know, I had given her her own chapters, but we knitted her up a bit. So that's what we did. And then it was shown, it was before the London Book Show, and Transworld won it. So that was wonderful. And then I worked with a great editor, Frankie Gray, in the UK, and an American editor for Berkeley. They bought at the same time. And we tweaked, as you do, you know, but not as much as with the other books that came after. I think because I'd had a long time to let it cook, to think about it, to revise it, you know, it was that first draft or second draft, really, after Maddie and I had worked on it, was a bit more polished, I guess, than the others, because the others you had to sort of write at full stretch. So
Yeah, it's so funny because you always think, you know, after the first book, the second book or the third book is going to be so much easier. You think each book is going to be so much easier. And I say on the podcast all the time that each book teaches you how to write it. You know, you can't think, well, this is how I wrote the first book, so this is how it's going to be for the second book. Because something you just said earlier in terms of you thought it would only need one point of view. And as the story starts to unfold, the book teaches you that one point of view is going to be extremely limiting. And that particular character only has access to so much information, which is why you have to start pulling in other POVs. And we're going to discuss that as well in terms of talking to strangers, the particular POVs you used. One more question I want to ask in general before we go to the book itself is, you know, we get a lot of submissions from journalists on the show to our Books with Hooks segment, in which we critique people's work and their query letters so that they can land their dream agent. And we can generally see who's a journalist and who writes in academia, because they have the certain style of writing where they just want to stick to the facts, and they really struggle with a character's interiority, their thoughts, their emotions, because all of this has been beaten out of them. You know, in journalism school, it's just the facts, just the facts. So when you decided to start writing fiction, was this a challenge for you? And how did you overcome it?
It certainly was a challenge, because I'd had 30 years of writing news, hard news, really, and then some features towards the end. But yeah, what I had to unlearn, first of all, was front loading. I mean, a journalist tells the story in the first paragraph. Well, in a thriller, that's not great, turned out. So I had to learn the drip, 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 which was good. I haven't really amended my style. I find it hard to write long, involved, you know, sub-clausey sentences. I'd rather just say it, move on. So I've kept that, but it was inventing was just so hard. At the beginning, I had to really kind of ground myself in, you know, conversations I'd had, people I'd met during my many years as a journalist, in order to be able to do it, because that's what I'd done. That's what I was trained to do. It was ingrained. I know people think journalists make it up all the time, but it's just not true. So making it up was quite hard. It was a real grinding of gears. And gradually, I let go. I mean, if you're going to write more than 10,000 words, you've got to do that. So I did let go. I let myself imagine. I let myself be those people. I mean, Jean, it was her voice that I had right at the get-go. That was what made me want to write The Widow. So I had her voice. So that was a real learning curve. But, you know, it's lovely to be able to do it now, you know, sort of flights of fancy.
Yeah, and they're two totally different writing styles, because I know, you know, I write fiction and then I once tried to write something from a journalist's point of view. It had to be a newspaper article and I sucked at it. It was so awful. I could not write it in this journalistic style. And I was like, oh my God, no, that is not for me. So I do feel very sympathetic for journalists who have been writing in this way forever and now suddenly it's a character's emotions and what are they thinking about and how are they feeling and how do you put in the backstory organically as opposed to what's currently happening now. So it is a balancing act for sure. But, you know, the fact that you got it right so brilliantly shows that it absolutely can be done. You just need to put on different hats and switch gears, I guess.
Yeah, that's true. But of course, journalists spend their whole time hearing about people's emotions and what they're thinking and what they would like to do and what's happened to them. You know, I used to teach journalism and, you know, people who say, oh, you know, it's good, you've got to be objective at all times. It's nonsense, because how can you tell somebody's story unless you can empathize, unless you can hear what they're saying and understand it and put it on the page? So that was a great base to work from. You know, I had all those people that I'd interviewed. So, you know, there were some great and good, but most of them were just ordinary folk who had had something extraordinary happen to them, or something awful normally, unfortunately. But you know what I mean? It's that sort of, so you do, you're gathering all of those emotions and the way people talk when they're upset and when, you know, when they're happy, when they're excited, you know, it's all sort of in there, which is lovely.
Yeah, and if you think about it, that is what storytelling is. That's what a story is. We take a character at their worst moment or their worst day where this inciting incident happens, whether it's a car accident, whether a child goes missing, whether it's a phone call in the middle of the night, and then that is what story is. So journalists are pretty much there at the genesis of all of these stories.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. It's a real privilege. You know, you're there on the day that somebody may never, ever forget, and you're part of it. You know, in The Widow, the journalist Kate gets Christmas cards from the parents of murdered children. And that's what happened to me. You know, I would only meet people for maybe, you know, 3 or 4 days, but I would be forever linked to what happened to them. So yeah, it is a privilege.
Yeah, very much so. Okay, so let's move on now to the book itself. So for our listeners, I'm going to read the flap copy so that you know what we are talking about. The book is called Talking to Strangers. Detective Elise King's investigation into a woman's murder is getting derailed by a reporter who insists on doing her own investigation in this nail-biting mystery from the author of Local Gone Missing. When Karen Simmons is murdered on Valentine's Day, Detective Elise King wonders if she was killed by a man she met online. Karen was all over the dating apps, leading some townspeople to blame her for her own death, while others band together to protest society's violence against women. In the divide comes Kiki Nunn, whose aggressive news gathering antagonizes Elise. As a single mother of a young daughter, Kiki is struggling to make a living in the diminished news landscape. Getting a scoop in the Simmons murder would do a lot for her career, and she's willing to go up against not just Elise, but the killer himself to do it. So that is our flap copy. Now, Fiona, I would love for us to discuss prologues. So for our listeners, you know how often we get prologues on the show, and Carly and Cece are like, I just don't feel like the prologue's working. And so often we see prologues that are tacked on as a band-aid to fix opening chapters that are not doing the heavy lifting that they need to do. Now, Fiona, I would love for you to first read the prologue for us and then for us to discuss the very first prologue you've ever written.
Sure, I shall do that. It's a very short prologue. It's about a page. So Friday, 14th of February, 2020. There were no takers at the pub, despite Karen's new dress. Red and sparkly, fun like her. She and Mina carried on laughing loudly at their table. But when Karen looked round, the dead eyes of people's wives stared back. Disapproval coming in waves, but she didn't care. Dol Harmon, the landlady of the Neptune, came over to clear glasses and have a quiet word. All right, ladies, you sound like you're enjoying yourselves. We are, thanks. You've done a great job with the cocktails and all the decorations, Mina said, raising a lurid-looking love potion in tribute. Yeah, Karen added. Not many blokes on their own, though. Dol pursed her lips. No, well, it's for couples, isn't it, Valentine's Day, she muttered. Not you, went unsaid. We're going on to a pub in Brighton anyway, Karen shot back. What are you talking about? Mina hissed as soon as Dol was safely behind the bar. I've got to get back for the babysitter. Don't worry, I'm happy to go solo. It's late, Karen. That's when the clubs really get going. And you can't drive after what you've had. Oh, what are you, my mother? I can get a taxi. Karen swallowed the last of her pink lady and slammed her glass down. Right, I'm off. But Mina had to steady her when she got up. What a shit evening, Karen murmured when they reached the pavement outside and gusts of rain drenched them. Her thin jacket would be ruined and she could feel her straightened hair frizzing. Well, I enjoyed it, Mina said sourly, turning on her heel and marching off without another word. Karen sheltered in the doorway of the newsagents until the shower eased to mizzle. The windows were full of hearts and fat cartoon cupids, and she suddenly wanted to smash the glass and scream at Dol with her pursed lips and the wives' club judging her. Who the hell were they to tell her how to act? She was allowed to have a good time. She was 45, not 80. Instead, Karen rested her forehead against the window and closed her eyes. The maraschino cherry from her last drink was repeating on her, and she knew she needed to slow down. She needed to regroup. Sorry, didn't mean to get arsy, she texted Mina. Thanks for being such a brilliant friend. I don't deserve you. Off home for an early night. She was already in bed when she heard her phone ping. She looked to see who it was and smiled. pulled her red dress back on and spritzed herself with joy perfume. She'd regroup tomorrow.
Wonderful. Thank you. And then for our listeners, after the prologue, it starts at sort of day one, which is the very next day. So considering that you wrote three books without any prologues in a genre in which prologues tend to appear, I would say out of all the genres that I read, I see prologues in sort of mysteries and thrillers and generally in fantasy novels. So you wrote three without any prologues. Then in your last one, Local Gone Missing, and in this one, Talking to Strangers, you decided to go with prologues. So why the shift and did your take on prologues change in the process?
Yeah, it did, because I'd never written a prologue before the first three, which were the Kate Waters books. They just started and off they went. But I felt that the books, Local Gone Missing and now Talking to Strangers, were different. They're told primarily, the narrators are a detective, Elise King, and there's a journalist and there's other people, other characters who narrate. So I felt it was different. I'd written Local Gone Missing and my editor came back to me and said, what do you think about doing a prologue? And the reasons that we came up with for doing one were that it would drag the reader in immediately, like a flash of the reader seeing what the story could be about, and then you're back into the narration. So I thought about it, and actually I wrote the prologue for Local Gone Missing in one take, and I really felt it added to the book. I don't know whether you want me to read that to you.
Yeah, that would actually be wonderful. Thank you.
It's very short. Okay, so the prologue for Local Gone Missing, the first of the Elise King books, starts, "There was something buzzing, a fly. Unable to move, he could only listen to its whining drone and try to follow it round the small room in his head. Where was it? Near the sinks? The drain in the floor?" There was a silence, and then it was flickering at the edge of his vision. He shook his head violently to stop it coming nearer, but it waited and landed just below his left eye, where sweat had pooled. It lifted off when he flinched, but was back immediately. He was totally at its mercy, and the fly seemed to know, loitering like one of those sullen teenage boys who hung around the high street. The fly danced over the damp tea towel plugging his mouth and moved towards his nostrils, rising and landing, the light brush of its feet and wings a subtle torture. When it finally flew off, it headed straight for the window, the sole source of light. He turned his head slowly to watch it frenetically beating against the pane before falling, exhausted, to the sill. It was a prisoner too. He closed his eyes and tried to focus on how he was going to get out. He didn't know how long he'd been there, how long he'd got before they returned. It was getting darker in the room. The summer evening was fading, and he struggled against his bindings one more time, until his muscles screamed for him to stop. It was useless. Maybe he could work the gag out and shout for help. He forced his mouth open as far as it would go, feeling the gristle pop in his jaw, and stabbed at the material with his tongue as he rocked in the chair. It was working, but the effort made the blood sing in his ears, and he began to choke. He stopped and tried to slow his breath, whistling down his nose, then bucked in his chair until it toppled over, crashing him to the floor. As he lay, he was suddenly aware of the silence in the room. He strained to hear the fly's whining and its pathetic attempt to break the glass, but there was nothing. Had it escaped? How? Dread spread like a stain through his whole body, and his heart started to bang against his chest wall. Someone must have let it out, while he was fighting to get free. Opened the door behind him and come in. He tried to turn his head to see.
Wow, chilling. So I never read that book. So just from that prologue, besides all the questions I have, it's like, I have a feeling that you're purposely hiding the name of this character so that the reader is like, who is this? Because you could have named him, right? But you keep it with he.
Yes, I did. I wanted them not to know who was the prisoner in the room, which is completely different to the prologue in Talking to Strangers, where you know who this woman is, and what she looks like, what she's wearing, you know a lot about her, you know a lot about her character by the end of it, and, you know, hunting, looking for love, and her friends. So they do two very different jobs, because the second book, Talking to Strangers, I wanted the reader to know who the victim was, and also the sort of the pathos of her last hours, because her body is found, you know, in chapter one straight away. That's how chapter one starts. So I want them to know who she is and what it's like to see somebody in their last hours, you know, sort of leading their normal life. And I thought it worked. I hope it does. Anyway.
Yeah, very much so. And what you've said, yeah, just really resonates for our listeners. You know, we always say do things with intentionality. You know, don't just choose a POV because, oh, I like third person or I like first person. Like, everything you do in your novel needs to be chosen intentionally for a specific effect. And I love what Fiona has just said here, because in our one prologue, we've got this huge curiosity seed in terms of who is this victim? Who is this person that is stuck here? Besides that, what has happened? Why is this person a prisoner? You have tons of these questions, so you're going to keep reading to hopefully get the payoff later. But with the second book, you know, in terms of seeing Karen, we create that pathos, which immediately humanizes her. So that once we have the, we have a body, it's not just a case of, oh, well, we have a body, we don't really care, because we've seen this woman who's just desperate to meet someone, who's desperate for love, and who's really putting herself out there, which immediately makes us feel for her, which I don't think we would have done had we not seen her once the body was found. So did you begin with that, Fiona, in the second book, or did you come back to that afterwards?
No, I began with it because I'm not a big fan of, you know, women appearing in books as the body in the ditch. I'm interested in them. I'm interested in the women. And I thought it would be interesting to do, you know, her last hours, to show her as a person, as you say, to humanize her, but also to introduce the judginess of people about, you know, women in middle age looking for a partner. There's an awful lot of judgment cast on them, you know, and as the book goes on, you'll hear some of the characters talking about, well, you know, she was asking for it, going online and, you know, putting herself out there, when in fact what she was doing was she was looking for love in a very honest way. So I wanted to sort of show that in a page, really, in a one pager, to show the sort of judginess that women like Karen face.
Yeah, and you make it look easy, but it's incredibly difficult to do that in one page, you know, without giving a whole backstory, without being like, Karen had always been looking for love in all the wrong places, you know? So you do it really well, but it is incredibly difficult to do. And can I just say, I mean, our time is running out, so I do need to wrap it up. And I just want to say that the social commentary in this book was incredible, and you never felt like you were being hit over the head with it, but there were so many times when people were saying, oh, well, she deserved it, she was looking for it, she shouldn't have dressed like that, she shouldn't have been out when she was, that I was just boiling with rage. And again, this was obviously very intentional on your part in terms of choosing Karen's character, because you could have chosen a sweet, innocent, you know, woman who'd been out on one date in her whole life and something terrible happens to her. But you very specifically took someone who's a very real person, in that lovely person has a whole life, has a whole history, has been dating people, has been doing all these things that other people will judge, as opposed to choosing a sort of murder victim who's completely blameless, as it were.
Well, I absolutely did that because I think real people are much more interesting. There's much more nuance. There's much more, you know, light and shade. And people don't live lives of total innocence. You know, it isn't real. And I like to, you know, ground things in reality where I can. And I know that, you know, it is the norm now. Women and men, actually mainly men, they do online dating. And that is a very normal way to meet people. And a lot of people meet their partners in this way. And yet there's still this kind of judgment that, you know, friends have experienced, you know, as if there's something slightly seedy about it. When, you know, what I was really interested in was the risks that people take by going to meet strangers, talking to strangers. So it was a bit of, you know, I took sort of different elements and wove them together. There are cases where you think the person you're going to meet is one thing, and when you get there, they're not. Or, you know, when they're talking to you, you think they're your new love, and they're, you know, three blokes sitting in a flat in East London running a boiler room scam. So there were lots of elements for me to get my teeth into. I really enjoyed writing the book.
Yeah, it was an absolute page turner for our listeners. I mean, I had tons of questions that we're not going to get to, but for those of you who are writing multi POV in terms of choosing the tense, in terms of choosing first versus third, in terms of writing characters in almost like a series, although each book needs to be standalone so that if the reader hasn't read the last one, they're not going, what the bloody hell's going on? In terms of plotting and pacing, you know, what I loved about this book is you need all the red herrings to keep the reader theorizing and speculating and going, aha, I think I know who it is. And then you're like, oh no, okay, I didn't know who it was. And there's twists and turns and the tension, maintaining the tension the whole time was just incredible. So for those of you who are writing in this genre, who are writing prologues, who would like to write about social commentary, pick up Talking to Strangers. We are going to link to it on our bookshop.org affiliate page. There is just so much, so much to unpack here. And we just ran out of time, Fiona. I'm so sorry.
Don't worry. I've really enjoyed
it. It's been an absolute wonderful discussion. Thank you so, so much. And we hope to chat to you for the next one.
Lovely. All right. Thanks so much.
After spending our summer vacation this year in Europe, it opened my eyes and my kids' eyes to the power of language and finding common ground no matter who we are and where we are. One of the most important things to me as a parent of two is making sure my kids see other places in the world and are exposed to the languages they speak around the globe. They're in French immersion education, and I'm honestly already getting left behind. I took French class in school until grade 9, and I have a big gap in my learning that I'm ready to fill. And that's why I rely on Rosetta Stone, the most trusted language learning program available on desktop or as an app. And it truly immerses you in the languages that you want to learn. I know my kids' language learning skills are going to explode past me, and I'm ready to catch them. And that's why we have Rosetta Stone. It's a trusted expert for 30 years with millions of users and 25 languages offered. We're talking Spanish, French, Italian, German, Korean, Chinese, Japanese, Dutch, Arabic, Polish, and many, many more. There is fast language acquisition. Rosetta Stone immerses you in many ways. There are no English translations, so you really learn to speak, listen, and think in that language. There's an intuitive process. You're picking up a language naturally, first with words and then with phrases and then sentences, and it is designed for long-term retention. There is speech recognition technology. It is called True Accent. It is built in. It's a feature that gives you feedback on your pronunciation. It's like having a personal trainer for your accent. It's convenient. There is super flexible learning anytime, anywhere. Learn on the go with a mobile app or on your desktop at your schedule. There is amazing value because you have lifetime membership for all 25 languages for any and all trips and languages that you need in life. That is a steal. That is 25 language courses from Rosetta Stone that they offer for 50% off. So don't put off learning that language. There is no better time than right now to get started. Shit No One Tells You About Writing listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. So go visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today today. Did you know that 70% of all books, including those traditionally published, are sold online via e-commerce? If you're an author wondering how you can get some of that market share, this is for you. Hi, I'm your co-host, Carly Waters. And I'm here to tell you how writers can work on their author brand and build an audience and convert those followers into book buyers. Ever wonder why so many authors publish books and later say that they didn't sell as many copies as they wanted? It happens over and over. And we see it all over social media. Authors think it's a them problem, but not always. They just weren't shown the way. And I don't want you guys to launch a book and show up at book events and have two people in the chairs. I've helped clients launch client books to the bestseller list for 15 years and have built a 6-module, 11-hour course with all of my knowledge that will give you the craft and book business information that you simply won't find anywhere else. And there's an app plus monthly Q&A sessions with me. 200 of you have already joined my new course. And as writer Siobhan Moore said, I'm halfway through the course and grieving that I didn't have this information sooner. There's really nowhere else to find it. Worth every penny. If you want the info that will change the course of your writing career, go to carlywaters.com/course to learn more and use discount code POD15, that's POD15 at checkout. That's POD15 at checkout over at carlywaters.com/course. I'll see you there.
Today's guest has studied dramatic writing at NYU Tisch and has earned numerous awards for her work in television, including a Daytime Emmy. She spent 5 years in rabbinical school before her chronic illness forced her to withdraw, and her father told her she should write a book, but just not a Jewish one, because no one reads those. Magical Meet Cute is her fourth novel. It's my pleasure to welcome Jean Meltzer. Jean, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Bianca. I'm absolutely thrilled to be here.
It's wonderful having you here. There's so much that I want to unpack. Before we dive into discussing the book, which is Magical Meet Cute, I just want to read the flap copy for our listeners so that they know the context of what we're talking about. Faye Kaplan used to be engaged. She also used to have a successful legal practice, but she much prefers her new life as a potter in Woodstock, New York. The only thing missing is the perfect guy. Not that she needs one, she's definitely happy alone. That is, until she finds her town papered with anti-Semitic flyers after yet another failed singles event at the synagogue. Desperate for comfort, Faye drunkenly turns to the only thing guaranteed to soothe her, pottery. A golem protector is just what her town needs, and adding all the little details to make him her ideal man can't hurt, right? When a seriously hot stranger mysteriously turns up the next day, Greg seems too good to be true. If you ignore the fact that Faye hit him with her bike and that he subsequently lost his memory. But otherwise, the man checks every single box, causing Faye to wonder if Greg's sudden and spicy appearance might be anything but a coincidence. Dun, dun, dun. Right. So I was thinking, Jean, about the elements that are required for a successful rom-com. And your book's title has it right there in the name, Magical Meet Cute. So can we speak a bit about how important the meet cute is in a rom-com?
So yeah, I think as every romance lover knows, every romance reader knows, the meet cute, the moment where the hero and the heroine meet, is one of the most important moments of romance. It's not just the introduction to our characters, it sets up usually the tension that's going to be in the story. And as we like to say, it's really where the fun begins.
And something that makes me laugh is the interpretation of meet cute, right? Because you think it has to be the super cute thing, but she hits this man with her bike. It is quite a violent thing. So again, in terms of what defines a meet cute, is it something unusual? It doesn't have to necessarily be cute. It can be an assault with a bicycle. Let's break down what romance authors consider a meet cute.
So one of the things to know about me is I'm on my fourth book and I write rom-coms. And I always like to tell people, emphasis on the com. I am writing comedy. There is a difference between, I like to say, a romance with comedic elements and a rom-com. A rom-com really aspires to a certain level of lightness, a certain, for me, what I like, a certain level of absurdity. It is based in realism, but it's sort of the extremes of our life experience. So yes, in real life, I don't ever want to hit anybody with a bike and give them amnesia. But reading about it is a very funny thing. And again, it's the setup of, she's already created this sort of golem. This guy shows up in her life. He's got red hair, which is her thing. And so it's setting up the humor of the story and the mystery.
Yeah, absolutely. In terms of the meet cute and the absurdity of it, it was ridiculously absurd and completely unexpected. And something that our co-hosts on the podcast, Carly and Cece, are always saying when they review opening pages is that you want to be surprising the reader. You want to be keeping them on their toes. You want something to be happening that is completely unexpected that makes them be like, oh, did not see that coming. Interesting. And so the kind of meet cute that can surprise the reader, I think, is one of the best ones. And like you say, if you can throw in the absurdity of it in terms of, he's the perfect guy, just a pity, you know, I've kind of wiped out his memory while I hit him with my bicycle. So in terms of other elements that make a really successful rom-com, I feel like witty dialogue is essential, the witty kind of banter, and also wisecracking sidekicks. So can we focus first in terms of the dialogue and the witty banter? When you sit down to write it, are you somebody who's really good with dialogue and dialogue comes to you first? Or is dialogue something that you have to come to afterwards and really polish up? I imagine as a screenwriter, dialogue is something that you are really essentially good at. Take us through your process when approaching writing dialogue.
So you're absolutely right. My background is in screenwriting and television. So for me, dialogue, it does not scare me. It feels very natural to me. And the easiest advice I can give in terms of witty dialogue or even writing dialogue is write like how you hear. Listen to people talking, watch television. I watch a ton of reality television. And it sounds crazy, but to just write how you hear people. You don't want it to feel stilted. The way we talk, there are ums, there are pauses. We are snarky. We make jokes. And all of that should be in your dialogue. I like to see that. So yeah, I love writing dialogue. It definitely comes from my screenwriting background where dialogue takes up the bulk of your page. And so for me, that does not scare me or bother me at all. I will say, however, I do not start with dialogue. I do not start with settings. I start with an outline. I write from a huge 10-page outline with all the beats. I'm a big fan of the hero's journey, the three-act structure, which bodes very well in romances and rom-coms. And I always, always, always start with structure. Probably also because I break so many rules when it comes to writing, you know, kind of like modern art, you need to know the rules in order to break them. So those are what I do. And I can't speak to anyone else, but that's what I do.
Yeah, very much so in terms of you've got to know the rules to break them. Important for our listeners to know. But also when it comes to dialogue, it's so important that different characters sound different, right? Because dialogue stems from everything that character is. It's their background. It's where they grew up. It's their level of education. It's their socioeconomic standing. It's the community that they are in. And so it's so important that when one character is speaking, that their dialogue sounds different from another character who might be an outsider or someone who doesn't share a similar sort of background. So how do you check for that? I know when I edit, I will read one character's dialogue, all of their dialogue, and make sure that if they use contractions or if they have like a word like damn, that they like to say damn in front of everything, that I'm not slipping that damn into someone else's dialogue as well. And that's not something I do on the first draft. It's something I come back to later when I'm busy editing.
So that's absolutely a fantastic point. Characters sound differently. I often have bubbies or elderly characters in my books because I write books about the Jewish community. There are characters who have what we might call a yeshiva accent, meaning that they grew up in a Yiddish speaking world. They might use dialogue that is Jewish dialogue. So they might use words and phrases that a broader audience might not be familiar with. But I'm very lucky. My characters, in many ways, I'm not someone who needs to sit there and do character sheets because I am writing from a place that I know very well and a people that I know very well. So it's, you know, outside of watching reality TV, I'm writing versions of people I've met my whole life. So if they come off feeling real, these secondary characters, it's because they are real to me. From the matzo ball onward to magical meet cute, I have been in these spaces. I've been in these places. I have dated these men. I've never dated a golem with amnesia, but you know, I'm sure for that, I do understand as someone with chronic illness, what it's like to have expressive aphasia, which is an inability to sometimes find the correct words or using malapropisms when I'm tired. So I was able to draw on that. So again, I'm writing from a space I know very well. And I think that's why the secondary characters come off feeling fun and authentic and lovable.
Something you've just said now, Jean, and we get that question a lot, is that if, let's say you're throwing in Yiddish words or phrases that are whatever language somebody's writing in. I know with my first novel as a South African, I was throwing in Afrikaans words that were authentic to those characters, but that my North American readers wouldn't understand. And you don't want to, after each time you use one of those words, stop and kind of translate it for the reader so that they understand. So if you are making it, your dialogue authentic in that way, how do you contextualize it so that the reader isn't stopping to look up what that word means, which takes them out of the story? It's important that it adds authenticity, but it doesn't confuse them or take them out. So what's your advice for readers who are doing that?
So it's interesting because there are very much two sort of trains of thought with this idea in contemporary, I would say, literary spheres, which is one, you don't define anything, that people are smart enough. If there's Google, if they want to go off and Google it or have a deeper understanding, God bless. And then the other side of that coin is how, you know, you do try to negotiate where things are defined, right? Writing in a definition that someone would understand. How do you do it in a way that it doesn't overpower the story? Same thing. I think for me, I do define within my books because I think there's a misnomer, a misconception that all Jewish people are born with a Talmud in one hand and a Bible in the other hand, and they know all the terms, and they know, forget about the broad readership, this belief that we're like a monolith and we all know the same things. I have Jews who read my books who have never celebrated a Jewish holiday, who are as secular as they come. My own community sometimes needs those definitions. So I always say, when you're defining, it's not just for other people and the broader audience, it's often also for your own community as well. How not to overpower it. You know, I always joke, I don't know what people don't know. So I do my best, but I'm always surprised by what people don't know. For example, a mezuzah being on the door. I've gotten emails, I didn't know what a mezuzah was. I thought that was a very common lingo. My favorite example of this, however, is salmon, bacon, and kissing kosher. They work in a kosher bakery, and one of the winning sort of dishes is a bareka with salmon bacon. Now, there was no comma in that, and I thought many Jews would understand that this was a bacon made from salmon, like a tempeh bacon or a turkey bacon. And I got so many emails from people telling me, like, how could they have bacon in a kosher bakery? Like, what is wrong with you? Like, are you even Jewish? Like, and so you will always be surprised by what you think. And, you know, if you read that book, I defined a lot of things. I talked about kashrut laws for people. I always try to, you know, give that background, that education, because I think it's what makes my book so much fun. You can have an access point. You can learn. But again, like, you can do all of that and then get 50 emails about salmon bacon. So what I would say to your audience is just do the best you can.
Yeah, excellent advice, because yeah, you want it to feel authentic. You want to slip it in there organically. You don't want to be heavy-handed with explaining each and everything. And you don't know what your audience doesn't know, but you also want to treat them like intelligent human beings. So there is finding that balance. Right, so we were talking about the awesome sidekicks. Now, I have a problem when I write sometimes that I find I tend to have so much fun with my secondary characters that it's like they think they are the protagonist and they start to sort of muscle their way into the page. And if you think of like good shows that we've enjoyed, think about something like Will and Grace, how, you know, Karen and Jack became way more fan favorites than the two main characters in that show. And it's been like that in other shows as well. So again, how do you reach that balance with your secondary characters who have got a job to fulfill? They are there to serve a purpose, but also you don't want them constantly grabbing the limelight.
This is such a great question. And I think in romance in particular, I think secondary characters is something I do very well. I'm very sort of, I often get emails about the secondary characters and people love the community aspect. I think the most important thing, and this was actually a review I read about matzo ball, but the idea of the secondary character is that they are pushing the journey of the hero and the heroine forward in some shape. They are not overpowering the story because they are literally the buffer, right? They are the everyman. They are the voice of reason when the character, they are functioning as the mentor role. So really the point of the secondary character, and going back to the hero's journey and three-act structure, is we love them. We love them. I think people, as you said, we all know that sometimes the secondary character, but really their job in terms of the story is to push the primary protagonist, the hero and heroine, to their happy ending.
Yeah, and that's something important for the writer to remember. I know I particularly like Save the Cat writes a novel in terms of story structure, and I think that works really well with rom-coms as well. And there is a part that says one of the action beats in the story is that the secondary character states like the dramatic question or the theme of the story in terms of asking a question that the main character then needs to address as they go on their journey and as they fulfill their arc. So it's really important to, when you write secondary characters, always be like, this is their function. This is why they are here. We cannot have so many that they overload the story and confuse the heck out of the reader who's like, who's this person again? What's happening here? And so when I critique manuscripts, I'll often say, can the next door neighbor and the barista not be the same person, right? Can they not fulfill the same role? I know you need this person here and you need this person here, but if they can be combined, it's less confusing. So again, I mean, you're writing about a community here, Jean. So community means a lot of people. So again, how do you have that sense of community without overwhelming the reader with too many people, too many names?
So again, I go back to that beautiful outline and also the fact that I have chronic illness. I struggle with brain fog. So if I go back to my book and my book is too confusing and filled with too many characters for me, it needs to be revised. I like to try to keep things simple. And also, I think in a scene, it's very hard to maintain four characters, five characters, six characters having a conversation. For me, it's hard to keep track. So I think I'm just very careful every day to sort of review and look at and say, is this working cohesively? Is it easy to read? Is it easy to understand? It's interesting. I actually want to go back to a point, Bianca, you said about the secondary character talking about the theme, because in the opening scene in Magical Meet Cute, you are correct. Nellie is the one. There's a moment where Faye, the protagonist, says to Nellie, who's this, we call her in the book, No Filter Nellie, because she's very old and she just says what's on her mind. They're having an argument about the pottery. Faye never feels her pottery is good enough. There's always imperfections. And Nellie is kind of berating her in this lovingly nudgy way. And Faye says, I don't need a mother. And there's a beat, as we would say, and Nellie says, everybody needs a mother. And one of the themes that come out in this book is that, or one of the things you learn about Faye is that she is the product of abuse, has a very toxic, bad relationship with her mother, and the abuse actually disabled her. So, you know, Nellie does in that opening scene, and the idea of imperfection and can things be loved if they are imperfect. It is absolutely that conversation with Nellie in the beginning that hits the themes of the novel going forward. So absolutely, Bianca, you hit the nail on the head with that one. Absolutely.
Yeah, because remember as well, and for our listeners, you know, our narrators are unreliable. They are imperfect. There are things about themselves that they cannot see. I often think about the people in my life who I love the most, who I wish so much they could see themselves through my eyes so that they could see how amazing and how incredible they are. But they're limited by their own insecurities, and so they will never see themselves the way I see them. And that's why it's so important to have those secondary characters interacting with your main character so that as the reader, we can get that outside view. We can zoom out from what's inside our main character and have them be seen in a way by someone outside the story so that we can see them more objectively. And of course, as someone who has got very few filters, I loved No Filter Nellie, and it was wonderful to see this character on the page and have her set up, you know, this dramatic question and state the theme of the novel. Right. So another aspect of a good rom-com is the tropes, you know. So what are some of your favorites, Jean? Is it a case of with each novel you try and mix up the tropes, you try not to go back to the same one? Or is it a case of there are some that you just simply delight in and those are the ones you're going to write about?
So it's interesting because for me, I actually start with a very clear idea of what I want to do in each book. And then from there, sort of the tropes come out of that. So for example, in Matzo Ball, I wanted to write a book that felt like a Hallmark Christmas movie, but also authentic to the Jewish experience. In Mr. Perfect on Paper, I had a very clear idea that I wanted to write an interfaith romance where the character really struggled between their love of faith and their love of a person outside of their faith. For my third book, Kissing Kosher, because I love a challenge, apparently, I wanted to write about sexual dysfunction in a romance. I always joke, my publishers clearly trust me because they were like, sure, Jean, go write about sexual dysfunction in romance. And then for Magical Me Cute, I really wanted to write a witch romance from the Jewish lens. And so from there, I had very clear ideas of what I wanted to do. And with Magical Me Cute, the trope of amnesia came out of the fact that how do you make in 2024 somebody appear out of thin air that has no history, that has no social media, that has no Facebook, that has no mom or brother or sister that you can call? The only way to do that in 2024 in a contemporary rom-com really would either to be have that person lying through their teeth for some reason, which again, most of us would not believe that, or I take this trope of amnesia and just erase all of his background so that this possibility of him being this supernatural creature she accidentally summoned becomes a reality. So that trope grew out of the necessity of the story. And then, of course, as a rom-com writer, we all love to see, oh, you know, a small apartment, one bed. I love a good cinnamon roll hero who has sort of an alpha exterior, but is really, really soft and sweet on the inside. And I would say again that my worldview very much influences my books. I tend to write men heroes who are very menschy, who are really trying to be better every single day in some way, even if they're faltering in that. And same thing with the heroines. But yeah, it's really, again, the necessity of the story. I've been doing this a very long time. And I think one of the things after, you know, I've been writing since a little girl in television and film and books now, I think I have learned that I do not let any little plot bunnies or characters sort of take me out of what I need to do for the story itself.
Yeah, I love all of that. You know, a compelling love interest in a rom-com is so important. And like you say, give me the menschy guy any day over the, you know, bad boy turned good. I struggle with a guy in the beginning who's a complete asshole, who's mean and who's just abrasive and mansplaining and, you know, so alpha male. And then by the end, he becomes whatever. And I'm just like, I'm not even interested in you. So I stop reading at that point because I'm like, you know what? It shouldn't take a woman to make you a better person. So those kind of romances bug me when it's like this real horrible guy and it takes a woman to like fix him and school him, etc. So yeah, for our listeners, the way you approach your love interest is so important because it can put readers off in the beginning or it can really get them on board. But again, not every book is going to be for every person, especially when it comes to romance. You know, there's level of spice. There's people who want all the spice. I've seen people go, I'm not reading this book. It was so boring. There was no spice. And then some people are like, oh my God, every page was sex. This was so off-putting. So, I mean, when you sit down to write, Jean, how important is it for you to picture who your reader is in terms of what you're going to give them? Or do you not picture the reader and you're just like, this is what I'm going to write and I trust that it's going to find the way into the reader who will love it?
So I would say you have to have both, right? So for me, let's start with the will my readers love it or expectations of the reader. I think by my fourth book, people have an idea of my brand as an author, right? I write a shticky, very fun, high comedy that also often usually tackles a deeper, more complex topic, such as sexual dysfunction, such as anti-Semitism, such as chronic disability. So on one hand, the beauty of being on your fourth book is there's a certain expectation and people know what to expect. Again, here's a little trajectory. When I first put out the Matz Ball, which was this first really big Jewish publication from a Jewish romance from a big traditional publisher, I think I felt, and I think we all felt, that we didn't actually know who was going to be reading this book, if they were going to be Jews, if they were going to be non-Jews, if it was going to be really broad. But as a Jewish woman, I know that there is a segment of the Jewish population that is shomer negia, meaning they do not even touch before marriage. So for me, not really being sure of who is going to be my audience, and also I was writing like a Hallmark style Jewish Hanukkah book, I was very conscious of the fact that like their antics had to happen before the age of culpability in like Jewish law, which was 13. I was very aware of the fact that Mamie, for this big Jewish romance, which was already sort of new for my community and world, that I probably wasn't going to open with a one-night stand, right? But now we're on the fourth book. We've been doing it a few years. There's more Jewish romances. We have a community. Everybody's gone through the foreplay a little bit. And now, like, people I have learned can be religious and totally cool with smut. So whereas for me, I don't usually have enough words in my book left to write sex scenes. That is the truth. I spend so much time world building, character building, the stories. If the story, again, I always go back to the story. If the story calls for it, I will write sex. So for example, in Kissing Kosher, which was about sexual dysfunction, I also wanted to give women tools for being able to overcome that in their own life. So there is a gradual progression in that book to a sex scene. I did not feel that, for example, in Magical Meet Cute, that it needed a sex scene, because to have sex with someone who doesn't have a memory, or you don't know his background, if he could be married or whatnot, could be very off-putting. So while the tension is there, I didn't feel it would necessarily add anything to the story to have them make love.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So very intentional approach to sex or not sex, and not just saying, well, this is a rom-com, so of course it's going to have sex. Last question, because we're running out of time, is I saw somebody talk the other day about how upset they get that their mother's favorite romance author is Nicholas Sparks. And they were like, this is not romance, because romance needs the happy ever after or the happy for now. It can't end in a certain way. And they were very firm about this. So in terms of you as a rom-com author, how important is the happy ever after? How important is the happy for now in terms of the genre?
So it's so interesting. So my sister loves Nicholas Sparks. This may surprise you. So I think different strokes for different folks, right? Like, we all have our thing. I would say, as a rule breaker, I mean, I put a lot of stuff into my romance books. I don't always open with a meet cute on the very first page. I do a lot of things that break rules, and I have found my audience. I think the most important thing when you're writing these stories is a level of authenticity and truth to yourself and what you want to do, because you can never make everybody happy. All of which to say, I am also a huge advocate of joy and happy endings. For my community, the Jewish community, I grew up in a world where it was Holocaust stories, where the person who was Jewish in the book was usually a side character, the girl with frizzy hair and a big nose that nobody wanted, maybe the comedic sidekick. So for me, the happy ending is incredibly important, because it is new for my community to see a story where two Jews fall in love and get to go off and live happily ever after. We did not grow up with these types of books. I did not grow up with these types of books in my world. So for now, I am always going to advocate for Jewish joy and happy endings in these types of stories. But also, again, as a rule breaker, I think there's room, you know, for a romance reader, the happy ending is the guarantee. You must do it. But we're all seeing more crossover, right? Women's fiction with happy endings and romances that are veering into women's fiction, and literary fiction that is veering into women's and fantasy and romanticy. So I would never want to say to anybody, like, let's do this or that, because there might be a great story waiting out there to be told in a new and different way. So,
what a perfect place to end. Thank you so much, Jean. For our listeners, we will link to Magical Meet Cute on our bookshop.org affiliate page. If you get the book there, you support an independent bookstore, which is so, so, so important. And you support the podcast at the same time. There are so many romance-oriented independent bookstores. So for our listeners who really love the romance, when you go onto bookshop.org, you get to decide which bookstore you are supporting. And I read an article recently that there are tons of independent bookstores that are being opened in the last while that focus purely on romance. The one that I used to know of was The Ripped Bodice, and now there's so many more. So if you're writing in the genre, support the independent bookstores who will support you as an author in this genre. Jean, we wish you much luck with this title.
Thank you so much. I hope everybody loves the book. I hope you laugh, belly hard laugh, and swoon. And thank you so much, Bianca, for having me here today. It was really my honor and pleasure.
A reminder that this is an unscripted program and our conversations have been edited and condensed and is not a full picture of our feedback or conversation directly with each author. As always, refer back to our written notes for the fulsome picture. Carly Waters and Cece Lira are agents at PS Literary Agency, but their work on this podcast is not affiliated with the agency, and the views expressed by Carly and Cece on this podcast are solely that of them as podcast co-hosts and do not necessarily reflect the views, opinions, policies, or position of PS Literary Agency. A reminder about all the ways that you can support us as a show: rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, tell your writing friends about us. We'd love to help as many writers as possible. And follow us on our Substack newsletter. Get our stacked newsletter on a weekly basis, bonus videos, articles, essays, advice, and more. You can find it at theshitaboutwriting.substack.com. That's theshitaboutwriting.substack.com.
And that's it for today's episode. I hope you'll join us for next week's show. In the meantime, keep at it. Remember, it just takes one yes. Fantasy writers, I hope you'll be joining me for the All About Fantasy full-day virtual retreat on the 28th of September from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Time. Whether you write YA fantasy, romantasy, adult fantasy, epic fantasy, cozy fantasy, dystopian fiction, or any other variation of the genre, you won't want to miss out on this amazing day of learning dedicated especially to you and those writing in your genre. The lineup includes award-winning and best-selling authors, as well as literary agents and editors who specialize in the genre. You'll have an opportunity to submit your query letter for critique. The Story Engine, who is sponsoring the retreat, is also hosting an awesome giveaway of an All Things Fantasy storytelling package that contains a copy of each of their decks, Story Engine Deck and Deck of Worlds, each with their associated fantasy expansions, the mythology, dystopian, and fairy tale boosters, valued at $237. All delegates will also receive discounts when shopping on the Story Engine website. Come and learn, ask questions, and even more importantly, build community. To find out more and to register, go to my website, biancamurray.com, and look for the All About Fantasy tab. I hope to see you there. Are you looking for beta readers, some of whom might potentially become writing group members down the line? Are you wanting to be matched up with those writing in a similar genre and time zone so they can critique your work as you critique theirs at the same time? Your manuscript doesn't have to be complete to sign up for this 3,000-word evaluation. Now, this particular matchup will be open to registrations from now until the 30th of September, with the matchup emails going out on the 1st of October. For more information and to register, go to biancamurray.com and look for the Beta Reader Matchup tab.